This is the Conversations with Eastside podcast. Eastside Church is a six-year-old church serving an eclectic community of worshipers on the east side of Atlanta, Georgia. My name is Ed, and I'm a member here at Eastside. Today I have Tim Lloyd, our lead pastor, and we're continuing our two-part conversation on our Wesleyan theological roots. Hallowed be thy name. We're picking up where we left off last week, talking about prevenient grace. Let's jump back into the conversation. Prevenient grace is a concept that, God is working in all people in all places. And it is a grace that everyone can exercise a decision to accept, which is that moment of justifying grace, right?
Right.
Whereas, the double predestination kind of prevailing belief would be God's grace is for a limited number of people and not for everybody on the earth. And that if God has chosen somebody for that grace, then they cannot deny it, but they will absolutely yield to it,
right?
Because they've been elected since before the beginning of the universe, etc. And so it's interesting to think about all the consequences of that. I remember even being like a college student and thinking about man, we talk a lot about predestination, free will, and I kind of don't care too much about it, frankly. I don't know how much it affects my life. But when you start to do the mental gymnastics and you deconstruct it, you're like, oh, it kind of has an impact on everything. It has an impact on agency, on volition, on the fate of human beings. It's contrast to really start to think about and dissect.
All right, let's go there. Here we go.
All right, let's do it.
We're going to go down the rabbit hole.
Yep.
So it's not just about predestination, isn't just about human souls. It's actually a larger statement about all of reality.
Right.
And if you take sort of Calvinist doctrine to its logical end, essentially, God has foreordained everything that has ever happened or ever will happen,
right,
in the history and the future of creation.
Every beautiful thing, every horrific thing, everything.
Correct. Free will is kind of... sort of an inauthentic idea in this paradigm. Humans think they're free, but if you're just living out a script that's already been written and you don't have a choice to divert from that script, you're not really free.
Right.
You were made as a Volvo, whatever, C-class. That's not a thing, but I'm not a car guy.
No, it is.
And you're going to function as you were created,
right,
by the person who made you, because that's... the way it works.
You're not a Porsche. You're not a Honda. You're a Volvo. You can think whatever you want, but you are what you are.
And you will do what you will do.
Yeah.
It's determinism, if you want to use like a philosophical term.
Right.
Or some would even push it as far as to say it's sort of fatalism. It's going to be what it's going to be. You might as well just sort of do what you do. Because you can't really change the future.
Yeah.
And... that idea exists within theology. That idea certainly exists within non-theistic philosophy as well.
Sure. Right.
Wesleyans don't believe that.
Right.
We fundamentally, and I use the word fundamental very carefully, we don't believe that. We believe that human beings have what's called libertarian, or to use a non-theological word, truly authentic free will. In other words, we're actually co-writing the script with God, and God's super curious and fascinated by the decisions that human beings make.
Right on.
That's not to take away God's power. God could at any time force our hand if God so chose to do that. Just like any human who's bigger and more powerful than another human being can force that human being to do something because they're weaker than the stronger human being. But Wesleyans don't believe God does that very often.
So does that mean that Wesleyans don't believe in... omniscience by definition, strictly?
We don't believe it's an important category. Mm-hmm. There's different answers to that question within Wesleyan. So one of my professors in college believed that God intentionally refused to look into the future.
So willful blindness.
Willful blindness, because God wanted to let every human being's free will be authentic. Because once God looks into the future and sees every free choice you're going to make, now it's in the perfect mind of God. Therefore, if God's mind is perfect and his omniscience is perfect, that person is, they have to do all those things because it's in the perfect mind of God. It's sort of a,
Sure. No. Yeah.
So it's like, right. Once you look, it's like you've sealed that person's fate and stolen their free will.
Yeah, that's right.
I think God has really good suspicions about what his free creatures are going to do most of the time. But I do think from time to time, human beings do things that God's like, huh, well, there you go.
Right.
Just like parents from time to time look at their kids and go, huh, that's awesome. Or, really?
Right.
Didn't see that coming.
Yeah. I mean, that makes sense. It's also interesting for me to think about this from the perspective of, you know, systems of belief today, right? Because we see under the banner of Christian, so many expressions of the Christian church and so much adherence to different types of doctrine and theology. And I think it's kind of interesting to put a Calvinist and an Arminian, or, you know, like a Southern Baptist and a United Methodist,
right,
you know, into a conversation or into a, you know, context where they worship together or something, and to see sort of like the Twilight Zone effect that happens, right? Where it's like, yeah, kind of the same, but then they're saying slightly different things, you know, like, yeah, they worship God, but like slightly different ways and for slightly different reasons, you know? And it's just fascinating. I think, yeah. Anyways, I have a personal opinion on that, and it's very postmodern, but I won't go there too far. So I think it's interesting for us to talk about what are those core beliefs. You talked about the three. Say it again. The three
manifestations of grace, convenient, justifying, and sanctifying, which are sort of different modalities of the same reality, the way they sort of manifest themselves in different ways in our lives and throughout our lives. You know. From being an infant, experiencing the prevenient grace of God, to accepting Christ and experiencing the justifying grace of God, to hopefully living out our lives and always seeking to grow in our holiness, grow in our relationship with God. And I should say this, John and Charles Wesley, Charles was John's younger brother. He was also a Methodist priest. When they were at Oxford, all these Eastern Orthodox transcripts from the early church fathers were finding their way into Oxford. So they were super influenced by the Eastern church. So a lot of our theology, though it's still Protestant, is very influenced by Eastern ideas of salvation as being a process, not being an on-off switch, but being this lifelong journey. We are being saved. We're not sort of like this, you know, we just don't use the same metaphors as a lot of other Protestant Calvinistic type groups do.
Yeah, you know, I think that without going into every single rabbit hole, I do think that there is a connection between these basic different assumptions and things like original sin versus original grace.
Right.
Things like, you know, the extent of depravity versus Wesleyan perfection. You know, like there are impacts that this has on kind of everything. And I just to pivot the conversation for a second, I think it's interesting to think about what this means for us in our world today. I was telling you about this earlier, the Rachel Held Evans, who's this really interesting kind of postmodern emerging voice. Yeah. Give it up to the Immersion Village. She's fantastic. Her books are fantastic. Her experience is incredible. You know, as a person who was, you know, hurt by the church and, you know, brought, you know, on a journey to discover her own expression and embracing of what Christian faith looks like and what a walk with Christ looks like in this day and age and for her life and her context. And then somebody else, you know, wrote a response to her expression, which was not necessarily, it wasn't like a contradictory one, but it was one that was just like, yeah, all the ideas that she claims are generative and new and interesting, or not new, but are sort of the solution. He says those are like uniquely United Methodist beliefs. And he was like, so really what she's asking for is more people to join the Methodist church. And, you know, it's not propaganda. It's not some kind of hidden message, because I don't think that was her intention. But he's the kind of commentator is interpreting, you know, that and inferring that a little bit, or sort of no, really interpreting it to be like, well, yeah, that church really exists. I was a part of a church that believed a lot of those kind of things.
Yeah.
How are these beliefs that have evolved from this history, from the beginning of the church through 1500 years into the Reformation and into, you know, Calvin and Luther and Wesley and their beliefs about prevenient grace and the three, I keep forgetting, three manifestations of grace and the impact that it has on how you form everything you know about God and your own spiritual walk and the Holy Spirit working your life. How is that, in a really unique way, do you think, you know, pertinent for the fate of the church today, maybe the Western church, maybe the American church today, based on what we're dealing with and where we are in the culture? And we have the emergence of the nuns, the spiritual but not religious, and people who large portions of the population that were previously predominantly Christian now kind of leaving the church, departing from the church, citing disagreement with the core beliefs of the church, right? In what ways do you think, or is it possible that some of these unique, these idiosyncratic Wesleyan beliefs, how are they especially pertinent in today's culture?
I think there's a lot of ways I could answer that question, but what comes to mind is, at its best, Wesleyan theology is an embodied theology. It's a very practical theology. It's a boots-on-the-ground theology. And, you know, even when we talk about, you know, Methodists talk about the means of grace, how we experience grace.
Right.
How grace channels itself into our hearts and our lives and transforms us. And we talk about two sort of main streams, the works of piety and the works of mercy. And the works of piety are everything sort of within the realm of church practice, spiritual practice. So prayer, worship, singing spiritual songs, getting coffee with someone and talking about how you're doing in your faith journey. Right.
Reading the Bible.
Reading the Bible. The spiritual disciplines like fasting and all of those things fall under works of piety. But the most critical in my mind within the works of piety is the Wesleyan theology of the Eucharist is so unique amongst Protestantism because it was directly impacted by the Eastern Orthodox Church. Unlike the Baptist tradition, who would see it as sort of just like this in remembrance, we just do it kind of because Jesus, it's a way for us to remember what Jesus did. Methodists believe like something actually happens when we break the bread and we dip it in the cup and we proclaim the words of transformation over those elements. And when we receive it, we're receiving the embodied presence of Christ into our physical bodies. That's dope. I'm sorry. Like that's the awesome. Real, that's like the real stuff. Like we have this real deep sort of sacramental reality behind us. And I don't think there's anything, there's not much more powerful to sort of the nuns or the post or the whatever you want to talk about Western culture as for me to get up there every Sunday and say, something's actually happening here. Like, this isn't just a ritual. This is something real taking place at this table. And when you receive, something real is happening to you.
Right.
And I think that there's just an immense amount of power in the Eucharist and in receiving the very presence of God into our physical bodies each Sunday. And I think if the Methodist Church wants to remain viable, they need to, on the whole, we need to radically reemphasize our deep sacramental theology that's often gotten co-opted by Southern Baptist theology. Right.
Yeah. You know, I think that's profound in so many ways. And, you know, and a dimension of maybe Methodist theology that doesn't get emphasized enough, you know. I'm also really drawn to, and you know, my personal story, like my dad is a very kind of fierce United Methodist. We, you know, in a Korean United Methodist church, which is sort of like the Korean immigrant church really took to the Methodist denomination and got a lot of support there. But he was really like a Wesleyan through and through, read the books, like went all the way back. And it wasn't like sort of a culturally limited expression, so therefore that got passed on to me. But that's not how I grew up, actually, because I ended up having my you know, more of my spiritual experiences in college in more of a Presbyterian kind of environment, much more Calvinist, much more kind of in that particular expression of Reformed theology. And then coming out, I sort of went on this journey. But what I find compelling that kept brought me back to kind of Methodism and the roots of that and how what an important kind of expression it is the idea of kind of empowered the journey of sanctification and what that meant, what the consequence of that meant about the way that I view my own life, my decisions, my responsibility and accountability. And, you know, I think that that really was important for me. Yeah. And I think and continues to be really important for me. I think that there are a lot of people out there who would look at a lot of the loudest voices in the Christian church and the Protestant church at large and say that there is a lot of prescriptive belief. There's a lot of foundationalist belief and a lot of, you know, veiled and maybe new kind of manifestations of what we just talked about from like a Calvinist perspective. And, you know, and again, and I also want to be really careful because I am sort of in my heart some, I don't want to go so far as to say like I'm a hardcore ecumenicalist, but you know, like I also, I mean, I totally would worship next to people who claim Christ as their savior, even in the difference of some beliefs.
Absolutely. Sure.
You know what I mean? Absolutely. Like, so I don't want to be like, well, that's not really Christianity. And under no circumstance do I.
Well, and just tangent, you know, I mean, when Wesley came over to Savannah in the United States, like he did open air revivals with George Whitfield, who was a double predestination Calvinist.
Totally.
Like they preached together the same circuit, the same revivals with and different like, theology.
There's something to be learned about that.
That's pretty remarkable. Yeah. So it's in our DNA from the beginning to be ecumenical. Absolutely. We can fiercely disagree and still worship the risen Christ together. And that's a beautiful thing.
So. And it's incredible you mentioned that because I think about even the effect of Wesley and the Methodist Church on the early American church and sort of like kind of the colonies and the frontier and kind of contemporaneous with like things like the Great Awakening and Jonathan Edwards and those guys. You know, so like it's very interesting to juxtapose these differences of belief, but recognize that like that God is at work and where there are disagreements on the way that we have parsed that and understood it, it's not enough to you know, separate or exclude necessarily, right? Even if like opinion means that we think we're right and that means we think they're wrong on that, but that doesn't mean that we believe that, you know, that they can't have some experience with Christ. Probably on the contrary, frankly, from the Methodist perspective,
right?
But I'm this is a very long way of saying, I do feel like today's, when I talk to people who are not churched people or who have had negative experiences with the church, it's really because of the idea that there is nothing good about humanity and that there is no sanctification that happens in a Christian and that it's really this idea of religion as a crutch, as faith as a parachute, at that, you know, everything about the Christian experience is like a rescue experience.
Right.
And certainly there are elements of that, but that's not the, that's not all there is to it for those kind of who subscribe to like a Wesleyan theological view.
Yeah.
And I think that that's a refreshing and necessary message.
Yeah, I agree. It's, you know, to use sort of seminary-esque language, it's a negative anthropology as opposed to a positive anthropology. It's focusing on the image of God in humanity as opposed to focusing on original sin or the original fall. It's focusing on an original blessing as opposed to, you know, humans screwed up at the beginning and now everything has been a mess ever since. And, I mean, it's easy to have a negative anthropology. Like, that is easy. Like, just read the news.
Right.
Like, humans are doing
it's broken
crazy
world.
Dumb stuff all the time.
Easy to have a low view of humanity, without question.
But I think I think that's part of the Methodist tradition is our belief that God's calling us to have a much higher view of God's creation, therefore to live lives that are a much higher expression of God's hopes for humanity. And that all gets back to the whole co-creating with God. And we're writing the story with God, and we have a stake in the game, and we get to make choices on how we want to progress, three steps forward, two steps back, or just regress. And yeah, so those are some of the Wesleyan distinctives.
Yep. So. Thank you, Tim.
Thank you, Ed.